from the Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Between the two world wars, some of the world's best minds engaged in what would be called modernology, or the study of their contemporary world disconnected from the past. On this week's program, Talking History's Drew Burgesson discusses this phenomenon with his guest, Harry Heratunian, the author of History's Disquiet, Modernity, Cultural Practice, and the Question of Everyday Life. And then in our commentary of the week, Ann Hulbert will look back over the past 100 years of child-rearing expertise to see if there's any consistency, any reassurance in what these hundreds of experts had to say. But first, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on December 12, 1901, Guglielmo Marconi successfully sent the first radio transmission across the Atlantic. Born in Italy on April 25, 1874, Marconi developed a keen interest in physical and electrical science. In 1895, he worked on a series of experiments, successfully sending wireless signals over a distance of 1.5 miles. Later he went to England, where he was granted the world's first patent for wireless telegraphy, and formed the Wireless Telegraph and Signal Company Limited. In 1900, Marconi took out a patent for a tuned or syntonic telegraph, and the next year, he successfully sent and received that groundbreaking transatlantic message, bouncing a signal, the Morse code signal for the letter S, off the ionosphere between Newfoundland and Cornwall, England. In 1909, Marconi and Ferdinand Braun were jointly awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics. When he died in 1937, the British Broadcasting Corporation ordered its stations to maintain a 2-minute silence in tribute to his pioneering work in radio.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a 1932 Pulitzer Prize is being questioned. The prize, awarded to the New York Times, should be revoked, according to a historian hired by the Times to review the winning work, a series on Russia by Walter Duranty. Mark von Hengen, a Columbia University history professor, criticizes the generally positive report as deliberately ignoring a forced famine in the Ukraine that killed millions of people. In his series of articles, von Hengen charges Duranty frequently wrote in the enthusiastically propagandistic language of his sources, and concludes that there is a serious lack of balance in his writing. And the USS Liberty case is being re-examined as well. Ward Boston, who was the senior legal counsel to the military investigation of the Israeli attack on the American battleship that killed 34 servicemen during the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, has issued a statement that the committee was ordered to conclude that the attack was an accident by President Lyndon Johnson and Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. In a signed affidavit released at a Capitol Hill news conference, Ward reported that the committee was told to find that it was a case of mistaken identity, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Israeli authorities apologized to the U.S. after the incident, explaining that they thought the Liberty was Egyptian. This is Talking History.
Bye.
Our guest this week, historian Harry Haritunian, is interested in the rise of intellectual interest in modernity, comparing the approaches to the subject by scholars in the West to those in Japan. Haritunian spoke about his new book on the subject recently with Talking History's Drew Burgesson.
Between the two world wars, a disparate group of intellectuals and philosophers developed an interest in everyday life. While many historians in the United States are familiar with the work of Walter Benjamin and Siegfried Krakauer, few are as familiar with their Japanese counterparts who simultaneously developed what they called modernology, the study of their contemporary world as a perpetual now, disconnected from the past and extending into an indeterminate future. Harry Haritunian, professor of history and director of East Asian Studies at New York University, as well as the author of numerous studies on the intellectual history of Japan, takes on this wide-ranging question of global intellectual history. His fascinating and polemical study, History's Disquiet, Modernity, Cultural Practice, and the Question of Everyday Life, published in 2000 by Columbia University Press, affords us penetrating insight into the nature of everyday life in the interwar period, the intellectual history of modernity, as well as the politics of history. Harry, welcome to Talking History.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You begin your story not after World War I, with the rise of international intellectual interest in modernity, but after World War II, with the creation of area studies in the United States as part of the Cold War. Can you tell us this story, please?
Yeah, I wanted to start with the perspective which was part of my own formation, which, of course, was the area studies programs that were installed in American universities after the war, and they served a whole variety of purposes, ultimately related to the national security state. And I mean, in many ways, it was really an expansion of some of the earlier service language programs that had existed during World War II, where young men and women were taught languages to serve as interpreters and extractors of information from the enemy. But the reason I start there is because the way area studies approached the world in the 1950s and 1960s was to essentially obliterate precisely that pre-war experience, which is in fact the focus of my investigations on the everyday life. I mean, it's almost as if it organized the world largely in terms of cultural regions, which had very little temporality, you know, associated with them. They appeared as kind of large, almost spatial constructs of continents, in other words, where nothing seemed to have changed. Part of this really was a spin-off of earlier attempts to kind of talk about national characteristics. There was an old social science from the late 1930s and into the 1940s, which placed a great deal of emphasis upon the capacity of social science to be able to talk about national characteristics, which were basically ahistorical, you know, so that Chinese or Japanese were the same today as they were during the Stone Age.
Eternal characteristic.
Exactly, eternal characteristic. And part of that really crept in, even though there were new forms of social science that crept into the teaching of various studies in American universities, it still remained basically ahistorical, you know, even though there were historians, in other words, that were always, you know, involved in any area studies program, so that I felt, you know, that it was important to bring that dimension of area studies into my own study as a way of kind of looking back on other ways we might begin to reimagine or re-envisage that crucial interwar period. One of the things that bothered me about area studies, especially in the East Asian programs, was that they were really kind of, they were basically almost amnesiac or forgetfulness about the immediate period, you know, there was leading to the war. It's almost as if, in fact, in other words, that period hadn't existed, or at least in the views of one really very famous historian of Japan, it was seen as a kind of derailment and not really worthy of any further, you know, examination. So,
and it was linked also to Cold War politics.
Exactly. It had everything to do with Cold War politics and in largely transmuting former enemies into friends. I mean, dealing with the Chinese in ways, you know, which had been former friends into enemies. I mean, that's really what it had to do with, especially the East Asia side. And, of course, the great model for all of these were these Russian studies programs that were organized first at Harvard and Columbia.
You often talk about this notion that non-Western countries are compared with the West or are supposed to become more like it, and you call this doubling. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I meant by that is that it was, I don't think it was ever really worked out. I mean, in the sense that in the organization, for example, of curriculum or curricula, you know, the words that would ultimately bring the study of, say, the Middle East or East Asia or South Asia or whatever into the academic procession, and this was really kind of a slow thing in the post-World War II period. Too often, the models that were used to bring these societies or the study of these societies were, you know, already supplied by the way Europe was taught, the way Western civilization was taught. I spent most of my time, you know, at the University of Chicago, well known for its intense interest in the teaching of Western civilization and the preparation of more of our materials. Really a good course, but when you began to use that as the basis by which to talk about, you know, the adventure of Islam or East Asia or what have you, I mean, you really run into a lot of trouble. And so what you get is a kind of doubling, basically. I mean, I could have used, you know, the other distinction between, you know, original and copy, but I think that was probably too strong. But I think that's implied by the doubling.
Right. It reminds me a little bit of the Sonderweg thesis.
Exactly.
For German historians.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, always copying, it's always a comparison of what Germany is as compared to what the West is.
That's exactly right, you know, and it's the West really standing, the West, the unity of this entity called the West, serves as a kind of a standard, or at least a principal criterion.
So what's the alternative to doubling then?
Well, I think that it's trying to look at these societies, and this is one of the things that interests me about the everyday, but it's really trying to look at these societies as essentially sharing, in other words, the same kind of imminent, or at least sharing imminent space-time configurations. I mean, that, you know, that put us, in other words, kind of proximately close to them. I mean, so too often area studies, or at least the approaches that were used by area studies, often saw these places either as these societies as living in another time altogether, different from ours, even though we were contemporary, or they represented some form of difference which, you know, we could barely grasp. But the point is, and I think my views really are about what really constitutes modern life. I think that one of the things about modern life is that you have to accept, in other words, that sense of imminence that we all share, and that would require us, in other words, to find ways to be able to talk about experiences which are both at the same time comparable, I mean, insofar as that we live in a world which is increasingly, in other words, dominated by capitalism and its own laws, and yet, you know, people come to this experience with, you know, different kinds of cultural equipment, basically, and, you know, so that we can note real differences. I mean, one of those differences was, you know, we recognized without really saying so, was the way Japanese went about, in other words, constructing a really powerful capitalist society in the post-war period, and people began to extol Japanese managerial techniques and so forth. That's only all that represented was just simply a kind of inflection, in other words, which has everything to do with the way, you know, the Japanese came to capitalism, you know, the conditions under which they embraced it and were able to kind of retain something of their own, in other words, past.
So a series of alternatives,
exactly,
rather than
yeah.
a norm and a difference.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, and in that sense, you see, I mean, that's one of the ways you go about studying modern society. I mean, it's not as if one is a copy of something, you know, of some modular form, but that these represent different kind of inflections, in other words, basically on the same scale.
Let's look a little bit closer at these definitions of modernity that were offered by interwar intellectuals, both in the West and in Japan. It seems that at the core of their definition of everyday life, and also yours, is this idea of capitalism and particularly commodities. How do commodities shape the modern world?
Well, I think that part of it had to do with the fact that we're dealing with, you know, one of the reasons I concentrated on the interwar period is that certainly with Japan, and I think this is true of a number of European societies, when you begin to look at just essentially gross figures, in other words, in terms of, you know, or quantitative data dealing with forms of economic development and grand national product, you discover that, you know, these societies, this is really the great moment for a really accelerated capitalist modernization. Japan was just simply one of a number of countries farther ahead than some, not as far as others, but I think we make too much of those so-called lags. And I think that what was at the heart of this, there were two things that were at the heart of this, which was the introduction of essentially mass society. I mean, that's what these industrial societies really are about. It's really about emptying the countryside, in other words, for these new urban sites. Places like Germany, as you know better than I, and Japan, I mean, the countryside was emptied almost overnight. I mean, cities like Berlin and Tokyo really grew almost overnight.
Right.
So that's one side, and I think a lot of that was signaled by the Bolshevik Revolution, which really did represent, at least momentarily, the beginnings not only of mass society, but the masses for the first time are in a position to actually write their own history, or write their own, which is really about their everyday. I mean, it didn't last very long, but I think that was a potent moment. And it seems to me that at the heart, the second real problem is the heart of this mass society, of course, is the commodity. That's the thing that holds these mass societies together, it dominates lives, it creates all of the tensions and frictions and unevennesses, in other words, that really mark everyday life. And so I felt that, one of the things that needed to be done is to find some unit, that probably best contains allows us to look at, in other words, the role played by commodities, and that was, of course, the everyday life. But it's not the only reason, because one of the things I found out subsequent, well, even during that time that I was working that, but I've done a lot more work on it, is that one of the interesting things is about the interwar period, both in Europe and in Japan, is the amount of effort that was devoted to really rethinking questions of time, and that
right.
invariably got people to talking about the everyday, either in some abstract way or ultimately, in with people like Walter Benjamin or Tosaka Jun in Japan in a much more material way. But, a way by which to deal with the quantification of time that both capitalism and science, in other words, had already installed as part of their own regimes.
So, let's pursue these two themes, because one is this category, everyday life, as if it's something different from daily life. And then the other one is this question of the temporality of modernity. What is new in its new time?
Well, I it's not that people didn't have daily lives before capitalism,
right.
But I think that daily life, before capitalism was simply a more contingent, in other words, type of existence. I mean, with capitalism, daily life becomes really regulated, in other words, by the rhythms of capitalism, by the work day, for example, by the routinizations. People like, all kinds of thinkers and writers began to call attention to, beginning with Zimmel onward, in other words, as to how everyday life, in other words, was essentially yoked, to industrial production, which took place largely in these cities, bringing together all kinds of people, in other words, from different parts of a country. Now, the thing that really interested me about that is that when you begin to look at the way, and it has built into everydayness the way people began to think of it as a unit of, I called it a kind of minimal unity, but I think that a number of thinkers began to look at it as a way by which to restore, in other words, to the dimension of time and temporality back to, like, qualitative time and temporality back to life. This is usually an abstract thing, and you get all kinds of people like Searle and Heidegger and so forth, in other words, really talking about another kind of temporal existence, more inner than outer, but nevertheless establishing the conditions for an everydayness, or at least the everydayness as a unit, as it's like a chronotope, isn't it? It's a new kind of time-space configuration. And what interests me about that, especially in a lot of these thinkers, some more explicit than others, is that it is kind of unintentionally juxtaposed to the nation-state, which, of course, before the great industrial, in other words, or the acceleration of capitalism, was, I think, the principal unit, in other words, of both space-time.
By minimal unity, you seem to suggest that there's something dissonant or uneven, is the expression that
you
use in the book, that's going on underneath this minimal unity.
Well, I mean, it's something that brings, people together around, in other words, the centrality of the commodity forum. I guess I'm one of those who really does believe that Marx's conception of commodity fetish is really a description of how capitalism operates. It's not necessarily, it may appear as an inversion, and that may be a way by which we can think of some other possibility, but it's not an inversion. It's not something that exists, in other words, behind a mask. That is the way things are. And I think that that's what constitutes, in other words, you know, as I say, the means by which people's daily lives, their work lives, their leisure lives, or at least their leisure time, in other words, is essentially organized. It's both routinized, obviously, by virtue of their the necessity of working, in other words, X number of hours, but it's also has within it elements of, you know, other forms of life and therefore of temporality, depending upon, you know, which society you're talking about and at what time. I mean, Japanese in the 1920s and 30s clearly were able to see, in other words, within large cities, in other words, the coexistence of earlier forms of, you know, economic activity, social life, you know, entertainment. And this was true, of course, in Germany and indeed in a number of societies.
And it seemed to me that in your argument that you were trying to suggest that these past events, instead of us look as historians looking back onto the past and imagining this kind of past that existed apart from our present, the past in this context kind of jumps forward and interrupts everyday life.
Absolutely.
And disrupts it.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of people have gone on to fancier ways of putting it by suggesting, you know, that the past constitutes a, you know, a kind of a permanent haunting, in other words, of the present. I don't see it. I mean, sometimes you can talk about it that way, but I think that the past is very, very much alive. I mean, in many ways, one of the things that's always bothering me about historians, especially, you know, they kind of unintentionally want to kind of bracket that past, in other words, by sort of suggesting that it's over and finished with, you know, it's been completed, but it's not. I mean, it works, you know, there's a really powerful kind of dialectical relationship between the past and any given present. I mean, in that sense, Benjamin is right. The present always conjures the past, and sometimes it's a great peril, of course, but, you know, that's the way it goes.
So a student reading Japanese intellectual history in the 1920s, what does that contribute to their understanding of these phenomena?
Well, it would say, they would show them that, you know, despite all of the, it would show them that, you know, it would give them, I think, not a, maybe a typical case, but certainly, one case, one instance of, among many, and, of what happens to societies when they commit them, their energies, you know, these transformations that are introduced by capitalist modernization. And, you know, the prices that are paid, the areas of society that are left behind. I mean, the commitment also means, you know, a commitment to reproducing, you know, on a permanent basis, forms of unevenness. I mean, we still do that. I mean, we live in presumably the most modern society in the world, you know, but I mean, living here in New York City, and I can show you just large sectors, in other words, where, you know, some other form of life is going on.
Right. Okay, thank you very much. My guest today has been Harry Haritunian. His rich study, History's Disquiet, ostensibly concerns the intellectual history of Japan, but as he demonstrates, Japanese ideas of modernity and everyday life are also relevant for historians of Europe and the United States.
For our site of the week, we'd like to call to your attention a new exhibit of rare artifacts that will give you a unique insight into the mostly secret lives of the Tibetan Dalai Lamas. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Fiona Beatty.
For years, only those who climbed to the fabled roof of the world glimpsed the sacred treasures of the Dalai Lamas. Now you can get a first-hand look at nearly 200 items used in their ceremonies and rituals in the exhibit Tibet, Treasures from the Roof of the World at the Bowers Museum in Santa Ana, California. There are other collections collected piecemeal, but this is the greatest collection within Tibet itself, said Robert Warren Clark, guest curator at the opening. We can see things in the exhibit that Marco Polo might have seen when he went to Xanadu. Among those items are a gilt silver prayer wheel that once held thousands of inscriptions and mantras, a skull cap that features a human skull and a mount of gold and embellished with turquoise, and the seal of the fifth Dalai Lama, made of sandalwood and inscribed in Chinese, Manchu, and Tibetan. Tibet, Treasures from the Roof of the World, will be on view at the Bowers Museum in Santa Ana through May 16th, before traveling to the Houston Museum of Natural Science, the Rubin Museum of Art in New York City, and Asian Art Museum of San Francisco.
For the last half century, parents have received advice on parenting from hundreds of experts in the field, G. Stanley Hall and Benjamin Spock, to name just two of the more prominent figures. These child psychologists have offered their help to new parents seeking to figure out what must be one of the most challenging questions they will ever face: how to raise their children, how to bring happiness to an innocent child, how to soothe the roiling teen, or how to exert enough discipline to produce a well-adjusted, productive adult. Our guest commentator this week, Ann Hulbert, has made a study of this self-help literature and has found some reassuring perspectives in what she's read. Hulbert is the author of Raising America, Experts, Parents, and a Century of Advice.
Rock the wailing baby or let her cry herself to sleep. Toilet train your toddler by two or let him take his time. Make sure your teenager knows about safe sex or preach an abstinence-only message. Infants, children, and adolescents can be a headache, but the child-rearing experts who have tried to help us have been just as hard to handle. The volume of advice issued to parents these days is staggering. Type in parenting at Amazon, and you'll come up with more than 23,000 titles. Among them, a recent spate of books warning that so much contradictory advice is unnerving parents. Those titles, too, have an alarming tone. Paranoid parenting, anxious parents, worried all the time. But a look back over the past 100 years, when scientific child-rearing expertise has flourished, offers an oddly reassuring perspective. In what sounds like a cacophony of advice, there has been surprising continuity. Ever since the turn of the 20th century, when grandmothers and ministers were edged aside by a new breed of medical and psychological advisors, two basic approaches to raising children have coexisted, each vying for dominance, neither prevailing. Again and again, American parents have been prodded and chided by leading experts who have presided as a sort of mom and dad duo, one a softer advocate of bonding warmly with children and allowing their natures to unfold, the other a sterner proponent of discipline and parent-directed nurture. The terse turn-of-the-century pediatrician Luther Emmett Holt peddled rigid infant scheduling, while the romantic psychologist G. Stanley Hall urged patience with impulsive adolescents. Between the wars, the behaviorist John Broadus Watson told parents to mold their children's future careers and stop kissing them. Arnold Gazelle, busy filming children's development, told parents to go with the flow. Even Dr. Spock, the post-war expert who reigned alone and supreme, was the exception who proved the rule. After the first child-centered edition of his famous book in 1946, he began worrying about over-permissiveness and took a firmer, more parent-centered tack in his 1957 revision. Now, as ever, the long-running debate between the experts frames the debate we're always having with ourselves and with our children. Is it more freedom or more control that they need, more authority or more intimacy that we want? As our advisors have served again and again to remind us, we want to have it both ways, which also means, as the experts of every generation have complained, that we parents can rarely be counted on actually to obey what any of them say.
You've been listening to Ann Hulbert, former senior editor at The New Republic, currently a columnist for Slate Magazine and the author of Raising America, Experts, Parents, and a Century of Advice. And that wraps up another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments and suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. If you'd like to learn more about Talking History and the Organization of American Historians, visit our website at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.